So here we go with the final section of 2 Samuel chapters 21 through 24. This is sort of an interruption in the narrative. If you took these chapters out and you went straight from chapter 20 into 1 Kings, you'd have a much smoother transition. This is a phenomenon, though, that we've seen throughout our study of the two books of Samuel because of the way that the various oral and primary written traditions were sort of sewn together by the people who gave us these books in this form. And these are important to sort of sum up the books of Samuel, and also by doing so prepare us for the action that's coming ahead in 1 Kings. And these chapters are organized basically in, you could think of it as three concentric circles. On the outer circle, you have two stories, and the chapter and verse citations for that are in your notes, but it's chapter 21, verses 1 through 14, and then chapter 24, verses 1 through 15. So that's the outside circle. The middle circle basically consists of two lists. And we've seen this twice before in 2 Samuel, where a major narrative section would be bracketed by lists of family members and officials, which symbolizes how the kingship was evolving into this sort of highly centralized bureaucratic structure, moving away from traditional life that the tribes had enjoyed before. And that middle circle, the first part is chapter 21, verses 15 through 22, and then the second half of that circle is chapter 23, verses 8 through 39. And then in the middle, you have two songs. The first one, a song of David, chapter 22, verses 1 through 51, and then an oracle of David in chapter 23, verses 1 through 7, which we're told are the final words of David. And as you may remember from 6 months ago when we studied the first few chapters of 1 Kings, that depicts him in a rather decrepit situation where there's very little that he can do. Now, there are a couple of different ways that we could look at this. One would be that it's kind of a minority report. And we've talked about the competing traditions that we see sort of sewn together like a crazy quilt in the 1st and 2nd Samuel. There were people who thought that David was awesome and that he vindicated the kingship. And there were still others, though, who said, David was not that great because the kingship was a bad idea from the beginning. God told us so when we asked for it. He said, you don't know what you're asking for. This is what it's going to be like. And everything that God predicted turned out to be true. But I'll give you one anyway, even though by asking for one, you're violating your covenant with me because I am your only true king. So you could look at it that way. You could look at it as an affirmation of David's covenant faithfulness with God and God's covenant faithfulness with David and by extension to Israel, as a way of saying, even though this was a bad idea, God has made lemonade out of lemons, and he still loves us, and he's shown his love to us through David, who, though flawed, as we all are, on the whole has been a pretty decent guy. Or you could see it as kind of a blend of both, where both aspects of the tradition are being represented by the folks who have put this book into the form which we now have it. So it's dealer's choice. You make the call. It starts out with the initial story, the first half of that outer circle, which is a three-year famine. And this is blamed on Saul's blood guilt. We've talked about blood guilt a lot. It's a really bad thing. David assiduously avoided it by not killing Saul when he had the chance on two separate occasions. And Saul is blamed for slaying Gibeonites. Now, there's a problem with this. First of all, David receives this oracle from God privately, not mediated through a prophet, and apparently there's nobody else around. So this is a very convenient oracle from God to receive. Because this would put him in a position where he could blame the famine not on things that he had done, Uriah the Hittite, but on things that his predecessor Saul had done that God had sort of waited around to square up with. The other issue is there's no textual evidence anywhere in Samuel that Saul carried out some sort of slaughter of the Gibeonites. Now, it doesn't necessarily mean it didn't happen. Absence of evidence does not mean evidence of absence. But it's an unusual situation, and it may be that these things that catch our attention hint toward the fact that David just wanted to wipe out basically all of the Saulite faction he could get away with doing, because whenever you have a royal household that you've succeeded, you always have to keep your eye on them, because they probably want it back, and they're probably feeling a lot of resentment. And the best way to deal with a potential competitor is to kill them. And it may be that that was David's motive, or it may be that writers supportive of David were trying to excuse what he did. Anyway, he decides to honor the Gibeonites' demand for restitution. The problem is they're not willing to accept the usual monetary payment that you would offer for blood guilt. No, they want more. They want people to kill. They want descendants of Saul. And David, you know, he and Jonathan had this really tight friendship. He promised to be faithful to him and to his descendants, and he continues to be in this case. He preserves Mephibosheth, but he didn't make that deal with any other member of Saul's family, just with Jonathan. So he took seven descendants, gave them to the Gibeonites, who impaled them, which is a pretty nasty way to go. I don't think they had crucifixion at this time, and impaling in that part of the world was kind of a popular way to kill somebody horribly. He shows a little bit of mercy in the end by retrieving the bodies and burying them along with Saul and Jonathan. It's a very small gesture when you consider how much those families had suffered. You know, he's trying to be responsive to legitimate grievances, even though those grievances may have been a fantasy, even though the demands may have been unreasonable. And so that's what's going on here. And that's the conclusion of the first half of the outside circle. Then in chapter 21, verse 15, we go into the middle circle, the list circle, where he's back at war with the Philistines. And you see David's soldiers killing these Goliath-like giants. You know, it talks about the spear weighing 300 shekels of bronze. It's very reminiscent of how David battled Goliath and killed him. And his soldiers, in this case, are killing these gigantic Philistines, sort of following in his footsteps, if you will. David wants to lead the fight, but his men say, no, go back. You're too important to lose. He's, by this time, getting on in years, we'll put it that way. So he probably didn't have what it took to really be an effective military leader. And as he's done before on a few occasions when his soldiers have asked him to stay out of trouble, he relented, you know. And this doesn't really paint David in a bad light as a coward or anything like that. In the Civil War, Robert E. Lee sometimes got over-enthusiastic, and he would get himself up in the front where it was very dangerous, and his soldiers would grab the bridles of his horse and force him back to the back. Because they knew that losing Lee would have been more catastrophic than losing 1,000 more men. That's the end of the first half of the middle circle of this ending. Now, in chapter 22, we get a really long song to God. David was, from the very beginning of his appearance in the text, credited as a great musician. And for the most part, this is similar to Psalm 18. You're probably aware that tradition ascribes most or even all of the Psalms to David's composition. There's really no way to know for sure. It's possible that whoever wrote Psalm 18 borrowed from 2 Samuel, or it's possible the Psalm came first, and the people who put 2 Samuel together borrowed from the Psalm. It doesn't really matter in the end, but the other song that this chapter 22 song relates to is the song of Hannah at the very beginning of the Samuel story in chapter 2, verses 1 through 10. And you may remember, it's been a while, that Hannah sings out a kind of lament to God that she doesn't have a son and she'd very much like one. Hang on a second. Let's just go back to it. And God grants her the son. And in chapter 2, she prays, "My heart exalts in the Lord. My strength is exalted in my God. There is no Holy One like the Lord. No one besides you. There is no rock like our God." And you see how similar it is in chapter 22, verse 2, where David said, "The Lord is my rock, my fortress, and my deliverer, my God, my rock, in whom I take refuge, my shield and the horn of my salvation, my stronghold and my refuge, my Savior. You have saved me from violence. I call upon the Lord who is worthy to be praised, and I am saved from my enemies." And we're not suggesting that anybody's cribbing from the Song of Hannah, but the similarity of the two kind of brings the whole story together in praise of God for God's wondrous acts, honoring God's sovereignty and His power to work through human choices, through human events, even when those choices are not particularly good. And of course, the focus throughout is on how God delivers Israel from danger, which sort of brings back echoes of Exodus 15 and Psalm 114. And you can look at these texts later in your own study time, where people cry out to God in the chaos of their lives, and God responds by saving them in one way or another. Now, in the middle of this song, verses 21 through 28, they have a slight departure from the theme. I'll put it that way. Let's try to be nice this morning. There's a claim that God intervened because of David's faithfulness and his innocence. Okay, I'll just read a portion of it. "The Lord rewarded me according to my righteousness. According to the cleanness of my hands, He recompensed me. For I have kept the ways of the Lord and have not wickedly departed from my God. For all His ordinances were before me, and from His statutes I did not turn aside. I was blameless before Him, and I kept myself from guilt. Therefore the Lord has recompensed me according to my righteousness, according to my cleanness in His sight." Uriah the Hittite. You know, you go back to 2 Samuel chapters 11 and 12, where, as you may recall, David seduces Uriah's wife Bathsheba. She gets pregnant. He tries to figure out a way to get Uriah to have sex with his wife so he can be off the hook, you know, for this love child. Uriah refuses to do so because the armies are out at battle, and he's not going to, you know, take life easy while they're risking their lives. And so finally, David plots with his chief general Joab and says, "Here's what I want you to do. I want you to put Uriah in the worst possible place to be in the battle, and then have everybody around him pull back, and so that he'll be killed." It worked, and David brought Bathsheba and his household to comfort her. And this is really the beginning of the trouble between God and David for this outrageous, outrageous thing that he's done. And so for David to be making these claims of innocence and fidelity have to sound a little ridiculous to anybody that's been paying attention. Walter Brueggemann, who's written a wonderful commentary on 2 Samuel, actually 1 and 2 Samuel in the Interpreter commentary series, writes, "The episode of Uriah the Hittite establishes that David is not blameless and therefore not entitled to the benefits Yahweh gives him. The words invite reflection on the tension between the moral seriousness of covenant obedience, which David confesses but does not live, and the free rescue of God. What intends to be moral instruction turns out to be a celebration of God's gracious goodness." And the remainder of the song does set aside this sort of Davidic self-justification and, "Oh, look at how awesome I am. All these wonderful things that have happened because I'm such a great guy," and emphasizes the fact that everything good that's happened in David's life, that everything that's good that's happened to Israel throughout the course of the monarchy is solely attributable to Yahweh and His might. Now, Chapter 23 begins with another song. A lot of times people think it's the same song, but the opening chapter of 23 clearly demonstrates that it is not. Now, these are the last words of David, the oracle of David, son of Jesse, the oracle of the man whom God exalted, the anointed of the God of Jacob, the favorite of the strong one of Israel. And this is a much briefer song. Again, close connection with the song of Hannah back in 1 Samuel 2. And again, to borrow from Brueggemann, both articulate God's resolve to have an anointed king, God's resolve to use the anointed one to bring well-being, and God's power to raise up a king congenital to God's purpose. And it shows how the king's power comes from God and God alone. It's intended to bring justice, and that it will be enduring despite the king's shortcomings because of God's hesed, because of his steadfast love and faithfulness. Because the kingship was designed to provide justice for the people, among other things. But the domestic policy God wanted pursued was justice. And as we see from Absalom's rebellion, which is the section that we covered last Wednesday, Absalom's chief complaint and the way that he sort of rallied the people around him to rebel against his father was that justice was not being executed. And apparently Absalom's claim was true because it was validated by the support that the people gave him. So the remainder of chapter 23 introduces the second of the two lists. So this is the second half of that middle circle in this sort of chiastic structure of the narrative. And it's a pretty long one with lots and lots of names. I'm so glad I don't have to read aloud. It's called the 30, led by an even more elite trio of soldiers. This was probably David's bodyguard and his vanguard when it came to battle. It's interesting that they're called the 30 because 37 names are listed. And I don't know what to tell you about that. You know, maybe seven of them were like junior members or probationary members. I'm just kidding. Nobody knows. And it's also surprising that Joab isn't mentioned. Now, there are a lot of different reasons to explain that away. Joab maybe didn't need to be mentioned because everybody just assumed that he was part of this elite group. It's possible that Joab wasn't mentioned because he wasn't a common soldier. He was a general, a chief general. But it could be that he's not mentioned here because he's being slighted. Because as we'll see as we get deeper into 1 Kings in the weeks ahead, Joab's going to be killed. And so this may be the beginning of sort of diminishing his importance to sort of subtly justify why he winds up being killed. And in the midst of this list, there's this really short narrative, and it's chronologically out of place. Again, they're fighting the Philistines, and David is bewailing the loss of Bethlehem. So this has to be happening early in his kingship, because for the majority of his reign, Bethlehem was secure. It was not occupied or even assaulted by the Philistines. So this is kind of a flashback, all right? And it can be confusing. And so what he does is he asks some of his guys, you know, it would just be really great to drink of that great Bethlehem water again. And so they go on this raid to get the water for him. They bring it back to him, and he feels guilty that he's done this, so he pours it out on the ground. And it's kind of like, you know, what a ungrateful person. I mean, these guys have risked life and limb based on how David describes it. Some have been wounded or perhaps even died to bring him a glass of water. And it was a selfish request in the first place. Maybe he didn't mean them to take it seriously. Maybe he was just sort of being melodramatic. But whatever the case, they did what they did. And this ingratitude, this selfishness, this stupidity, may be how the Minority Report wants us to read it. Okay? This element that has serious doubts about David and his kingship. But it also might be another affirmation of his humility, his humanity, his sense of regret at the sacrifices men made, and his sense of undeserving that this water, which cost people blood and lives, is something that he doesn't deserve to drink. It's a weird little story plopped down into the middle of this list, and it's hard to say what it means because you can interpret it in a couple of different ways. The final section, the final part of the section is chapter 24, and this is the complement to the narrative of famine that began it in chapter 21. God's mad. It doesn't tell us why. He's just mad. And, you know, I think we can all sympathize with that. Sometimes you're just mad and you don't know why. And God tells David, take a census. And David obediently does what he says. Now, Joab is concerned about this. He doesn't understand why David is calling a census. It's very time-consuming. It absorbs a lot of resources. Censuses are generally used for exploitation. In this case, as we see once it's finished, apparently the census was used to ascertain how many able-bodied fighting-aged men there were in the northern and southern parts of the kingdom. So a census was a tool used to exploit people for taxation and a whole host of other things. It was an implement of control, the very same type of thing that God warned the Israelites they were getting themselves into when they asked for a king in the first place. And David gets the results, and he knows that he's done something wrong despite the fact that he's just doing what God told him to do. And so he begs God for forgiveness. And it's just strange. You know, God set all this into motion, and now he's going to take vengeance on David and the people. He's going to punish them harshly. The prophet Gad comes to David and said, okay, God's giving you a choice of three. You can have 3 years of famine. You can have 3 months basically fleeing from the enemy, so you can, it's military defeat. Or you can have 3 days of pestilence. You can have 3 days of a terrible plague of a disease. David doesn't want the people to be militarily defeated, which would have been the most significant threat to the legitimacy of his reign. And he doesn't choose between the remaining two. He leaves it up to God's mercy. Let God decide. So God goes on the shorter sentence of 3 days, and during that period of time, 70,000 people are killed. So whatever it was nasty. And again, this harkens back to the plagues that God sent against the Egyptians, which were designed not primarily to release the Hebrews from their slavery in Egypt, but primarily to demonstrate God's glory and supremacy to Pharaoh and to the Egyptians. That's why he hardened the heart of Pharaoh, so that he could keep on going until he got through all 10 of them. Which is a difficult way of looking at God. But it's a demonstration of God's sovereignty and God's capriciousness. It makes me think of the book of Job, which, if you're not familiar with it, has nothing to do with Job's patience. He's far from patient. He just stays faithful. He refuses to curse the name of God. He demonstrates the fact that he loves God not because God's blessed him, but because God is worthy of his praise and adoration. But this is a situation where God sets in motion a terrible sequence of events that afflicts Job, basically so that God can prove to Satan, ha-satan, which from the Hebrew translates as the prosecutor or the accuser, so that he can prove to this member of the heavenly court that Job is truly a faithful person. God stops. No reason is given. Perhaps the 3 days had elapsed. It's strange. It's strange. It presents a significant theological problem as to what the purpose was. I mean, what use does this serve? Or is God just angry? And as we often are when we're angry, we just blow up at a person who has nothing to do with why we're angry. I mean, but God's got to be beyond that. the text doesn't even give us a clue. What the text does tell us is that David takes responsibility. And he is. I mean, apparently God's wrath was kindled because of the census, which David made happen, even though he only made it happen because he was obeying what God told him to do. You know, go ahead and bang your forehead on the table if you need to. I'm just about there. David repents, takes responsibility for what happened, which, you know, is what a good leader does, you know. So maybe the entire story is a way of showing David's humility toward God and his willingness to suck it up for the people. God stops the killing. David goes out to make an altar at the location where it stopped. It seems like it was just a wave of plague, and then all of a sudden, in a very arbitrary way, it just stops at Araunah's property. David wants to buy it. The owner says, no, I'll just give it to you, because you know, I'm pretty glad the plague stopped here too. And David said, no, I'm going to buy it because I will not offer burnt offerings to the Lord my God that cost me nothing. It tells us at the very end that God stopped the killing because David erected the altar and made sacrifice. Even though it's already told us in verse 16 of chapter 24 that God's already decided to stop the carnage. So, again, confusion attributable to the fact that the oldest manuscripts we have don't always agree, and that the reason for that is you've got a crazy quilt sewing together of a variety of different sources advocating in opposition to one another in terms of, is the monarchy a good idea or not? Was David a good king or not, on balance? And I think it's wonderful, despite the sort of idiosyncrasies that it causes in the text, that the people who put this together and gave it to us decided not to exclude one voice over the other. It's kind of like, let the hearer decide. And obviously, it's slanted more toward affirming the monarchy and David as king. But they could have whitewashed it all, but they didn't. They didn't. Because they realized that maybe it was both. Maybe it could be that the kingship was necessary and sanctioned by God, and that David was, for the most part, a good king. But at the same time, he was a deeply flawed individual and monarch, and God did not want people to have the king because it was a disruption of their covenant, because God's the only true king that Israel or anybody else can have. And I just think there's deep, deep wisdom in that, and I adore it, especially living in the age that we do, where it's very much I'm the one with the only truth. I'm the only one with the accurate facts. And anybody who disagrees with me is just flat out wrong. I think recognizing the sort of multiple voices we get in Samuel, which we're going to continue to see in both books of the Kings, maybe is a life lesson that we take from this, that multiple perspectives are meant to be valued and preserved, because both in their own way carry an element of truth, and that only together can we find the fullness of truth that's available to us. Okay.
I think you've been watching too much news on television.
Well, I keep up, although I actually am
that's
on
what
a...
what it sounds like. I'm, is what we're
yeah.
watching today?
Oh, absolutely. And it's... that's one of the things that I love about Scripture. You got four Gospels, not one. And three of them are rather similar to one another, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, although they have quite different takes on what it means to call Jesus Messiah and Son of God. John is like way out there on his own, kind of going rogue with his own later perspective on who Jesus was and why he came. And then you got Paul, and you've got James, who have very different understandings of what grace and faith involve in terms of the believer's role in responding to these gifts of God and exercising their faith properly. You know, there are two creation stories. Boom, boom, one after the other. Most people don't even realize that. But there are two distinct creation stories at the beginning of Genesis. They're in different sequences, and they're pursuing slightly different purposes. And it would have been very easy for them to say, no, this one's more right than this one, but they included both. Because in their wisdom, they saw that, well, between the two of them, we get a pretty good idea of why God bothered to create in the first place. So what else y'all got? Yeah, Caroline, and then we'll go down to Beverly.
Well, I'm looking at this wonderful impaling.
Yeah, charming impaling, isn't it? Yeah.
And I'm looking at this and thinking that some of these people will probably show
up. It's possible.
Of course, five sons of Merodach, the daughter of Saul, I mean, those would have been Saul's grandchildren.
Yeah.
And it just really.
Well, his grandchildren were probably in their late teens to early 20s. Because remember, David reigned for 40 years total. When he came to the throne, Mephibosheth, Jonathan's son, was a minor. And so by now, Mephibosheth is kind of a middle-aged guy, and he is a grandson of Saul. So it's hard to peg how old these children of Saul's other wives were, but it's likely, based on the timeline, that they were in their late teens to early 20s, because people back then didn't wait until their mid-20s to late 20s to get married and start having children. They got going about a decade earlier than we do now. Generations were much shorter.
Isn't this Meshulbah or whatever his name is, isn't that just, that's not Jonathan's son. That's another person. That's another one with the same name.
Well, yeah, what it says in chapter 21, verse 7, but the king spared Mephibosheth, the son of Saul's son Jonathan, because of the oath of the Lord that was between them, between David and Jonathan, son of Saul. And we're going to see more of this when we get into 1 Kings.
Because he was crippled, he couldn't possibly be a king.
Right. So he was easy to spare. He wasn't a legitimate contender. There is a footnote in my study Bible, and I hope it's in yours too, wherever you see Mephibosheth, that says Merod Baal, which is an alternative name. And then it sends you back to the note at chapter 4, verse 4, where it says, Mephibosheth, the original form of the name was Merod Baal, which you can see in 1 Chronicles chapter 8, 34, as well as in 1 Chronicles chapter 9, verse 40. Was it two different versions of the same name, or did the kid have two different names and he went by both? Or are we looking at two different people who sort of have gotten confused up?
Well, I think it's two different people, because it says that this Meshulbah was the son of
Well, no, you're looking at verse 8. The king took the two sons of Rizpah, daughter of Aiah, whom she bore to Saul, Armoni and Mephibosheth, and the five sons of Merib, daughter of Saul, whom she bore to blah, 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 blah. So, yeah, you've got a couple of Mephibosheths in here. And there's no reason to believe that you couldn't have two kids named Mephibosheth. I mean, there are a whole lot of Emmas out there, and a whole lot of Bens.
But you're saying that you don't think of any of these sons, that the grandsons of Saul would have been children?
It's possible if they were like later children, but it's more probable that they would have been considered to be adults.
Okay.
that they would have been in their late teens to early 20s, just because of the time lapse. You know, by now David's nearing the end of his kingship. We're not exactly sure where, but, you know, the indication is given that he's very close to the end of his life. First verse of chapter 23. Now, these are the last words of David. And when we get into the very first chapter of 1 Kings, David is in the last days of his life. So, round about 40 years have gone by, and when his reign started, Jonathan's son Mephibosheth was a little kid. So by now, he's got to be in his 40s. So it's plausible to say that these children of Saul's other wives who were impaled couldn't have been much more than 20 years younger than he was.
Well, my footnote says this event took place early in David's reign over Israel and originally came before chapter 9:1.
Yeah.
David asks if anyone has left in Saul's house.
And that's something called redactional criticism. And what it means, redaction is, we all know what redaction is. You know, when you do a Freedom of Information request, if there are things they don't want you to see, but they legally can't not give you the document, they just take a Sharpie and they sort of mark over. That's what it's called, redaction. It's a process of editing. And so what that commentator believes is that this is a event that has been displaced in the timeline, and actually belongs much earlier in the narrative, around about chapter 9. That would actually make more sense in a lot of ways. It would have made more sense for David to eliminate all these potential competitors early in his reign instead of near the end of it. Okay? And this is true for the entire final section. The scholars say this would make more sense here, this would make more sense there. And so we think what they've done is they've taken these sort of random little scraps and they've sewn them together and they've stuck it here for these purposes. Boom, boom, boom. And it's, you know...
It looks better if he's giving... grandchildren.
And that may be part of the purpose of this particular episode being located at the end of 2 Samuel, near the end of his reign. Because you're right, if this story does belong much earlier in the narrative, they would have been children. Which isn't to say that David wouldn't have done it. It certainly makes David look better for him to be doing it here rather than earlier. Yeah.
Right. And then I think about, would he have done anything about reburying everybody if the concubine hadn't put all the sacrifices and ashes and made a big display there?
Yeah, I mean, I think he's responding to her grief. I mean, it's a very public display and a way that he can sort of, you know, getting behind him is to, you know, provide an honorable burial to the people who were sacrificed to satisfy the Gibeonites, by basically disinterring and relocating the remains of Saul and Jonathan so that they could be buried all together. That's been an important theme throughout both books of Samuel. Yeah, they wanted the sons. And they specifically said in verse 6 of chapter 21, let 7 of his sons be handed over to us, and we will impale them before the Lord at Gibeon on the mountain of the Lord. The king said, I will hand them over. And obviously these are not all sons. In fact, they're all grandchildren. But same difference, doesn't matter. At least from the perspective of retribution in those days. And, you know... redactional criticism, as I said at the very beginning of the gloss on the text, says that the narrative would flow better if chapters 21 through 24 weren't here. Because, you know, just read chapter 20 of 2 Samuel, skip the rest, and go straight to 1 Kings. It slides better. Okay? But the presumption is that the goal of the original compilers was to have a continuous narrative. That they would have found the disruption in the narrative problematic. And that's not necessarily the case. We have narratives where there are flashbacks. We have narratives where there is what could be, oh, my Lord, I just poured myself decaf. I'm kind of in bad shape today. Maybe I just drank from the pot. In literature, I guess the best example I can think of in terms of this whole, if the narrative is discontinuous, then something must be wrong thing, is a Quentin Tarantino film. Have you ever watched one of his films? Kill Bill is a great example, although you see it in Pulp Fiction, you see it in Inglourious Basterds. The narrative isn't sequential. And you actually, as you're watching the movie, it's part of what develops suspense in a narrative that otherwise would not be suspenseful, because you're having to put together these disparate, ill-timed elements, and it's not until the end of the movie when you really have a clear idea of what's going on. And that's what I really love about Tarantino. It's also a smart way to make a film, because then you have to go back and see it a second time to make sure you actually do understand what's going on. It's a very, very clever way of filmmaking. It's kind of like going up to the window at Churchill Downs or Keeneland. You pay your money, you take your choice. So are the redactional critics right, or is, what we have in terms of the earliest sources, are they an accurate representation of the way the story wanted to be told, rather than kind of a mishmash? Because, they're certainly trying to be true to the narrative, while at the same time, the various elements of the tradition, they've got dogs in the fight, So this could be a situation where supporters of David said, well, we know this probably belongs with the events here, but let's cram it deeper down in the story toward the end of David's kingship, so it's not obvious that he's sacrificing little kids to be impaled. Well, the women don't matter, because, they... Right. Yeah, you need to get rid of the boys, which is probably why he ascended so readily. It's hard to imagine if the Gibeonites had said, we want your kids and grandkids, that he would have assented to their request. He would have probably just conquered their butts and let that be the end of it. But instead, this was an opportunity for him, And again, how convenient. How convenient. Because the famine can't be David's fault if it's attributable to Saul's blood guilt. And if the people who were victims of the blood guilt aren't willing to accept remuneration, but instead demand eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth kind of thing, and say, we want Saul's sons, which are actually grandsons, it's two birds with one stone. The famine's not my fault, David can say, and at the same time, I got to give the Gibeonites what they asked for, but it helps him solidify his throne. Because he gets to eliminate seven other potential contenders. Because he's getting old, and these guys, if the story's in the right place in the narrative timeline, are getting old enough that they can present a challenge to him. He's just survived one from his own son, Absalom. So,
David doesn't appear to want to repent about giving them away, though. I mean, he just goes ahead and does it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, he gets to quiet down the Gibeonites. He gets to confirm the claim that the famine is Saul's responsibility, and he gets to eliminate. So what? He's got nothing to be sorry for.
No.
I mean, the situation is set up where he can do this guilt-free.
Well, he's the one who said that Saul would cause the famine, David.
Right. I mean,
he's the only one.
David inquired of the Lord. The Lord said, there is blood guilt on Saul and on his house because he put the Gibeonites to death. And, you know, again, no textual evidence here that Saul did that. That doesn't mean that he didn't. It just means that it's a pretty important thing that you might want to have talked about when Saul was king, if this is where we're going to wind up at the end of David's story. And the fact that David sort of got this in private, you know, it naturally raises suspicions, you know. I mean, it's the same sort of suspicion that many people feel around John Smith, who found golden tablets underneath a stone and was the only one who could read them. You know, that causes a lot of suspicion for people when they sit down to read the Book of Mormon, understandably. And, you know, so David, you know, gets this oracle from God. There's no evidence that it's mediated through a prophet, which is normally how that would have occurred. And, you know, how wonderful for David. Oh, what's going on with this three-year famine? Well, and people had to be thinking, well, somebody's done something wrong. David's the king, and so therefore he must bear some measure of responsibility. Well, looky here, it wasn't me at all. It was Saul who slaughtered all those poor Gibeonites so long ago.
You know, with all the slaughter and all the killing and everything that happened during this time, Saul and then Galen, you really sometimes wonder why God let them have a king.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, he wasn't for it. We know that based on the readings that mm-hmm. we had. But if you look at the consequences that happened for these poor people,
yeah,
over this time period, you really wonder why he didn't break it off right away and say, no king, I'm the king, let's reaffirm that to everybody, and let's be done with this.
Yeah, you know, it...
Because I don't know if you learn anything, Michael. I mean, here are these people going through all this stuff at the time.
Yeah, I mean, it appears as if God is essentially providing Israel with a very long-running object lesson. You don't know what you're asking for, so I'm going to tell you. And even though God does tell them through Samuel, the people refused to listen to the voice of Samuel. They said, no, but we are determined to have a king over us, so that we also may be like other nations. I'm reading from 1 Samuel chapter 8, verse 19 and following. And that our king may govern us and go out before us and fight our battles. When Samuel heard all the words of the people, he repeated them in the ears of the Lord, as if God couldn't hear them in the first place. The Lord said to Samuel, listen to their voice and set a king over them. And they did. And, you know, God has relented before to the cries of his people when they have been oppressed. And now, ironically, they're asking to be oppressed. They're crying out to God for a king, and he answers them affirmatively. And this goes on for centuries. You know, it's not a brief experiment. And you do wonder, after Saul, why God didn't just call it off.
Yeah.
You know, but David was there. Better king material, so let's give this another shot. And then you got Solomon, and you know, it just gets worse as it goes along. And it seems like the whole point of it was, I'm going to give them kings, and the kings will become increasingly corrupt, They'll become increasingly unjust and idolatrous. More and more they'll forsake the covenant they have with me. And eventually I'm going to empower the neighbors of Israel to conquer them. When their moral fiber has become so compromised that they're essentially defenseless, and by being exiled and enslaved again, as they once were in Egypt, they will finally recognize the gravity of their sin, my true nature as their king and sovereign. They will become more faithful to the covenant, at which point I will restore them to the promised land without kings, although it doesn't quite turn out that way. You can read Ezra and Nehemiah about that. Beware what you wish for, because God may very well have an unpleasant lesson for you in that.
Century after century.
Yeah.
I mean, it's most people would think would pick up on this if this is not working well.
Yeah. But then it's no longer in their control.
No, that's right.
They've lost control, just like God said they would. I mean, in essence, they were enslaved before the Babylonians ever marched on Jerusalem. They were enslaved to the very monarch they asked for. And God told them as much.
Interesting.
So they exchanged freedom for slavery for two major motives: peer pressure. They wanted to be like everybody else around them and have a king. And insecurity, because they wanted somebody to fight their battles for them.
Those are two big points, if you look at it, right?
Yeah. It reminds me, I think it was Benjamin Franklin said, those who are willing to sacrifice their freedom for security deserve neither. Yeah.
I mean, just beginning to get it. And I think in my text, mainly David, then it came me after the battle story, David, who was a handsome young man playing his harp in the field, writing psalms, tending the sheep, and killed Goliath.
Yep.
Not this David. Had they studied this? I don't think there's any way they were named it yet. I have never really studied it this closely. I'm kind of appalled.
It begs the question that maybe we need to investigate your life a little bit.
He might want to.
Names are not.
I'm not going to be mean to him. Yeah. It's not the way we think of David.
Yeah. Well, and true. And, you know, I'm glad that we're spending time with these stories, challenging and sometimes disturbing and repetitive as they are, because they're not well known. And David was, as all of us are, a deeply flawed person. Yet the prophets continually refer to the coming anointed one as one who's going to be like David. In fact, a son of David. And Matthew, Mark, and Luke go to considerable pains to demonstrate that Jesus is a legitimate son of David, which is one of the boxes you've got to tick to be Messiah. And so for the later prophets, David was definitely best among all the kings, and someone like him but better would be the one who would come to fully liberate and properly govern Israel. And Jesus fulfilled that in ways that were very unexpected, in terms of what he liberated people from and the type of victory that he led them to. So we can criticize David rightly, as the text does. That's faithful biblical interpretation. among all the exemplars of an institution that should have never existed, he was the best.
The anger of the Lord burned against Israel again, and that's when the Lord incited David against them. So, you know, we're blaming David for calling the census, but really the anger of the Lord incited David to do it. I want to say, why would God make somebody do something wrong?
Yeah, I mean, it's...
it's not... We're learning a bit about God can be pretty Machiavellian at times if he wants to be.
Oh, very much so. I mean, and you know, I think that's one of the reasons people don't read the Old Testament. We much prefer the God we get in the New Testament as revealed through Jesus Christ. It's hard to reconcile that revelation of God with the revelation that we get in the Old Testament. And so the easiest thing to do is just, you know, pick the pretty parts of the Old Testament and leave the rest. And so the story we know about David is the ruddy, handsome boy who was a good musician and killed, you know, and took care of the sheep and killed Goliath with a slingshot. And he was a good king, but, you know, a deeply flawed one. And the reality is the God that we have is sovereign and capricious. And capriciousness is inherent to an entity that's fully free. Okay? Because we don't understand why God does some of the things God does. You know, I mean, it's hard for us to understand why a human being who is also the only Son of God had to suffer death upon a cross in order to redeem the world of its sins and reconcile us to God. I mean, there had to be a different way. Jesus even asked in the Garden of Gethsemane before he was arrested. He said, you know, if there's another way, I'm open to ideas. Let's talk. But your will, not my will, be done. And since God is God, one does wonder, could there not have been a different way? But God chose this way because of the fact that from God's vantage point, which is the only one that matters, this was the best and only way to reveal the true nature of his love and to conquer sin and death once and for all. And so there's just a lot going on in the Old Testament that's a serious head scratcher. Job being one of the biggest exemplars, you know, because everything that happens to Job, all of the misery he endures, is basically God trying to prove a point. And he's testing Job, but the purpose of the testing is for him to prove a point.
I think that Robert Frost, the mask of mercy, or mask of reason, that he wrote here, God says to Job, I owe you thanks. You freed me to be God.
I like that. Well, and a Job, in a way, is the minority, one of the minority reports of Hebrew Scripture. The vast majority of Hebrew Scripture is retributive justice. Good things happen to good people, bad things happen to bad people. And you see little bits and places here where, like in Isaiah, God in an oracle says, I make my rain to fall on the just and the unjust. In other places he says, my thoughts are not your thoughts, nor your ways my ways, says the Lord. And when Job finally cries out to God, and, you know, seeking some answer for why God is doing this, what does God do? Does he have mercy? Does he have compassion? No, he slaps him around. Job chapter 38. Then the Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind. Who is this that darkens counsel by words without knowledge? Gird up your loins like a man. I will question you, and you shall declare to me. Where were you when I laid the foundation of the earth? Tell me, if you have understanding, who determined its measurements? Surely you know, or who stretched the line upon it? On what were its bases sunk, or who laid its cornerstone when the morning stars sang together and all the heavenly beings shouted for joy? Or who shut in the sea with doors when it burst out from the womb, when I made the clouds its garment and thick darkness its swaddling band, and prescribed bounds for it and set bars and doors and said, thus far you shall come and no farther, and here shall your proud ways be stopped? Have you commanded the morning since your days began, or caused the dawn to know its place, so that it might take hold of the skirts of the earth, and the wicked be shaken out of it? Have you entered into the springs of the sea, or walked in the recesses of the deep, and on and on? I mean, for chapters, you know, basically God saying, who the hell do you think you are? I know I've made you miserable. Why are you whining? Who do you think you are to ask me a question? So the whole book of Job is, bad things do happen to good people. Good things do happen to bad people, and we don't know why. Because at the end of the day, if that's what God wants, then tough nuts. I mean, that's the message. Ecclesiastes is another minority report, if you will, when it comes to saying, no, retributive justice is not a consistent explanation. You can be moral and good and faithful to the covenant, and bad things can still happen to you. That's just the way of the world, because God has deemed it to be. Because He's God. That's the only explanation. Which is terrifying.
Try to stay on His good side.
Well, even if you stay on His good side, you could still wind up like Job. You know.
Sonny, my Bible just says that the threshing floor where David publicly sacrificed for his sins, God chose that site for Solomon's temple.
Mount Moriah.
Aruna, whatever it is. Threshing floor of the
temple was.
Became the site God chose as the location of Solomon's temple.
Yeah, I don't. That's not in the notes of my study Bible, and I didn't encounter that in the commentaries that I consulted. So that may be more of an aspect of tradition, because we're not entirely sure where this is. We're not given any sort of precise location. I guess we'll just have to discover as we get into 1 Kings and the temple actually gets built whether or not this is connected with the threshing floor of Aruna.
When you said this, David better king than Solomon? Man always thinks of Solomon being wise
before
you get into it, did he bump off as many people and have as much of a
Solomon's
life as seems to have done.
Solomon's real issue was idolatry. That was the besetting sin of the kingship and the one that ended up getting them conquered. And Solomon was the most rapacious of kings. I mean, to build the temple, he really put a strain on people. We mentioned at the end of the last section where we have one of those lists of court officials in chapter 20, verse 24, Adoram was in charge of the forced labor. That's the first mention of someone being in charge of forced labor. It will not be the last. The temple, glorious as it was, as we get into the construction of the temple, it's easy to see Solomon was sucking the kingdom dry of everything, including labor, to get this done. Did the end justify the means? And then Solomon, after having constructed this temple to the Lord, he later on in his reign ended up practicing idolatry. That practice continued and became more pronounced generation after generation, king after king. And then, of course, it spread from the king, sort of like poison leaching into a well. It spread into the nation, and pretty soon you have people violating the first commandment on a regular basis. It's 11 o'clock, so I've got time for one more question or comment, and then we're going to have to go.
There's stuff about that in 1 Chronicles 21.
Mm-hmm. Is that where we get that from, Chronicles?
That whole story about going there and buying it, and he says, no, I'll give it to you, and then David says no. And then I'm looking, say, around 24 to the end. So I don't know if that means he had sacrificed there, but to me, the way that this text is, it implies maybe he. And then 22:1, 1 Chronicles 22:1. But then it says taking into account that Chronicles' agenda is the.
Yeah, I'm scanning through it real quick.
Mm-hmm.
In chapter 22 of 1 Chronicles, verse 1, then David said, here shall be the house of the Lord God, and here the altar of burnt offering for Israel, and which implies that this would have eventually been the site of the temple. But there's some inconsistencies in the narrative between 1 Chronicles and 2 Samuel, including the name of the guy who owned the property. And Chronicles, which basically is a repetition of the material that you cover in Samuel and Kings, has its own agenda. And basically the agenda of Chronicles is to promote the monarchy. There's no minority report allowed in Chronicles. We got to go. Next week.